Best year ever.
For tonight's music special, we are going back 40 years with one of Australia's most beloved musicians, rockers and legends. 1985 was a big year for music and a life-changing year for our very special guest. Now, Working Class Man would become Australia's unofficial anthem and the signature song for Jimmy Barnes. It was one of the hits on For the Working Class Man, released in December 1985. That album, his second solo one after Cold Chisel Days, rocketed him to a mega successful solo career that is still going 40 years later. And I'm delighted to say Jimmy Barnes is here with a playlist of songs from that same year, 1985. Welcome to Nightlife, Jimmy.
How are you doing? Nice to talk to you.
Wonderful to speak with you, Jimmy. Now, I think it was a little bit difficult for you to narrow down to 11 songs.
I've got to tell you, because, you know, when this idea was put to me about making a playlist of songs of my favorite songs from 1985, I started looking around 1985 and I'm going, man, I don't like a lot of these songs. It's like, there's a lot of like real 80s hits there as well, you know, and there's something about 80s production that got very, the technical side of recording got changed radically, you know, over the previous 5 years. And there's all sorts of glitz and glamour going on. So I had to sort of listen for a while and then go back and think about what's a great song, who's a great singer, who's a, you know, what changed the way people think. And once I did that, then 1985 once again became a great year for me.
Right. And yeah, it's that sort of, maybe Huey Lewis in the News said it best with Hip to Be Square. Everything got very overprocessed from some point, from pub to production.
He's a friend of mine, actually. He actually played harmonica on Freight Train Heart. And like his hits in that were one of the ones I'm going, oh, I'm not sure if I like the way this sounds. It was about the way just the record sounded at the time. But you know, there's a lot of you know, once I started digging in, there was a lot of really, you know, transformational music that really meant a lot, you know.
Well, we're talking about 1985 as the best year ever, and I'm sure Working Class Man would absolutely be top of the list. Why do you think Australians love it so much still?
Working Class Man, the song?
Yeah.
I think it's always first and foremost goes down to the song. I think Jonathan Cain, who wrote that song, and you know, and if I can just give you a bit of background on that, Jonathan was a songwriter, producer, who I was introduced to in America through Geffen Records, and he, you know, he wanted to work with me, and he, you know, he knew my work. I didn't know a lot of his work because he played in a band called Journey.
Yeah, Journey. Yes, I've had a look at Jonathan. Yeah.
Huge in Australia, and it wasn't really my kettle of fish. But you know, as I work with John, and I can hear his songs a mile away now, I really appreciate the work he did. But he also played with a band called The Babies, and wrote with The Babies, who I really liked, you know, and I loved, you know, he's worked with John Waite and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, I went into a meeting with Jonathan, and he presented me with a song that's on the Working Class Man album called American Heartbeat. Now, poor old American Heartbeat, when I was told that the title, I said, no, I don't think I want to do that. It's not really my sort of song. And that was before I even heard it. It was just, you know, going on the title. And the A&R man said, I really think there's something special going to happen between you and Jonathan, and I think you should come and meet him and talk about it. So, you know, I kept an open mind. I went in, and Jonathan and I started talking, and we got on really well. We both loved the same music. We both loved all the same stuff. And he was explaining about how American Heartbeat, the song, was about how music changed the landscape there and how the world was changing around it and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, that's okay. I'm sure we can, as Australians, can relate to that. So I said, yeah, okay, John, you know, and just because I liked him so much, I wanted to give it a go. And I said, let's go into the studio and cut that song. From there, he started, you know, we started just talking, and he was talking about Australia. And he obviously, you know, as Journey, they'd never toured down here, or The Babies. And he really had a bit of a hankering to get down here, I think. And so I told him about, he said, tell me about your audiences. And I was telling him about playing clubs in Wollongong where, you know, the steel towns where people, you know, they're so keen, you know, you finish your set, you do three encores, and you be in your little dressing room, and somebody will climb three stories up a drain pipe to hang their head in the window and say, do another one, you know. I said they're people, they're really wild, but they're salt of the earth. You know, they really care. They work hard all week, and they go out and they kick their heels up in the weekend, and then, you know, sprung up ready for work on the Monday morning again. And we just talked about that sort of stuff, and he really loved it. And we said, "Oh, it's great, nice to talk to you," and I hung up, thinking, you know, in a few weeks' time I was going to go in and record American Heartbeat only. A week later, Jonathan rings me and said, "Oh, well, I've been thinking about a conversation, and I've written a song for you called Working Class Man." And my first thought was that it was going to be some cheesy song about me being a working class man, which I am. You know, I certainly come from a working class background, which I'm very proud of. But it wasn't. He said, "This is about your audience," and I immediately thought, "Oh, that's a nice sort of angle to write about." You know, like to tip your hat to the people who come out every night. And so he sent me the song. And he'd hit the nail on the head so well with the lyrics. I just thought I felt something in the melodies and in the structure of the song that resonated with me instantly. And I thought, this is a really great song. And even more so when I went to the studio and recorded with them. I remember doing it finally once in the you know, singing with the band, and came into the control room to listen. And from that point, I thought, this song is going to change my life, my career.
Mm.
It was really great. And what it did for me was it was the anthem about proud about being working class, proud about, you know, it might be a struggle, but you're always going to pick yourself up and keep coming. And you're not afraid of hard work. You're not afraid to get your hands dirty. If it's doing the right thing to raise your family and do all that sort of stuff. And all those things resonated with me as a young man, and coming from a working class background. And I think that that's similar thing that why, you know, the Australian audience sort of connected with it. In fact, so we did so much so that when we put the album together, because I wanted to have some of these other tracks from Body Swerve that we'd redone with Bob Clearmountain and Lisa.
Okay, so he's my uncle, by the way.
Is he really?
Bob Clearmountain, yeah, but through marriage. But yes, I've interviewed Bob before on this show.
Just a little while ago.
Beg your pardon?
Exactly, here about 3 months ago.
Yes, that's right. For my cousin's wedding, I was there too.
Yeah, I love Bob. He's like, he's the best in the world.
Yes,
and Bob, that's a lovely connection. Bob, who I still, no matter, you know, 40 years down the track, when I have anything I want special, I send it to Bob to mix. You know, he did on my last record. He was the guy who was mixing for me. But anyway, so I did all this work with Bob, and I wanted to include that on this album. And it was particularly because we remixed the songs and redid the songs for the American album. But to put them on the Australian album, it meant it was going to be like 16 or 17 songs or something like that. And it was going to be too much for one vinyl. So that meant we had to go to double vinyl. Double vinyl in those days in 1985 costs, you know, $40-$45 or something like that, you know. Mm. It's expensive, you know, really expensive for the time. And, you know, we wanted a double gatefold. We wanted to open up and have great pictures and have posters in there. I wanted it to be real value for money. And Michael's going, you know, Michael Gudinski, who my dear friend and partner in the last 40 years, was telling me, saying, "Oh, you know, this is too expensive to do." And I said, "Michael, we have to find a way to make this work." And so I think it was Michael came up with the idea of calling the album For the Working Class Man. And what he did was he pulled all sorts of deals and you know, not cut corners, but, you know, shaved money off of things so that we could get that record with a really great gatefold, with great clips, and still sell it for under $20, which was unheard of at the time. So it was literally our gift back to, and, you know, I felt like I wanted to do that because a bunch of those songs were on Body Swerve. I wanted to give these new updated ones back to the public, and I think that whole ethos of you know, keeping the record for the working class people, making it so it's affordable. Music was spiraling out of control. People were just charging a fortune for everything. Record companies were making way too much money, and it was good to give something back. And I think all that is what really appealed in 1985 to the record buying public.
Yeah, the working class budget, but working class budget record. That's good. Just like too many tracks for a vinyl, Jimmy, we've got a lot of songs to get through, so let's get into it. First up, you've chosen a love song by Paul Young that went to the number one in the US. Why is that?
Well, listen, I just thought I love Paul's voice. Paul's got one of those voices that as soon as you hear it, it's like somebody putting a warm blanket around you. It's warm. It's really soulful. he's a guy who, when I heard Paul sing, I just thought, what a great voice. This guy's got to be, he's got to have a great soul, he's got to be a great human. And I met him, and he was just the best guy, really soft and really, you know, a caring person. And everything he did, everything he sang, I just went, man, you know, you could sing the phone book, and I'd like to hear this guy sing this song, you know, with his the production on this. It's a guy called Pino Palladino playing bass, who brought some real magic to the band, all those bass notes that are singing fretless bass that's on the record. And I thought of all the 80s big splashy production things, this song, you know, it was a classic thing. The production dates, but Paul's voice is so soulful and so grounded that it cuts through all that, and the song will be timeless.
Here it is. It's Every Time You Go Away by Paul Young. That was Paul Young with Every Time You Go Away. I'm here with the legend, that is Jimmy Barnes, for our music special this Saturday night here on Nightlife. Look, Jimmy, we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, but if you could describe the sort of music you were into personally in 1985, how would you do that?
Wow. You know, I was listening to, you know, it was pretty sort of trashy sort of rock and roll, really. I mean, most of the stuff, you know, I always liked soul music. You know, that's always come through for me. You know, there was smatterings of English and British soul, you know, that was coming through that I liked. But I always liked, you know, R&B from America, black music. So I was listening to a lot of that. But I was also, you know, like, I was listening to, like, the Pirates, Out of Our Skulls, you know, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, who were doing sort of great, you know, like garagey, trashy, sort of, they sounded sort of Texan. You know, I was listening to a lot of Texan music, you know, at the time and all that sort of stuff. Edgar Winter, Johnny Winter, you know, Rick Derringer, all these things that were sort of really, really Texan bar bands. And the reason I really liked the Texan bar bands is because they reminded me of Australian bar bands.
Right, right. But with that soul music, I was watching an old interview that you did for 60 Minutes, and you're cranking out the soul music for the kids when they're really little. Was that sort of thing common for them growing up?
Well, my kids, like Jackie, my son was named after Jackie Wilson.
Oh, there you go.
Mahalia was named after Mahalia Jackson, you know. Eliza Jane was named after my grandmother, by the way, who was a, you know, Glaswegian soul singer.
Okay.
No, not really. She just got drunk on a Saturday night and sang. But all my kids really, they were very influenced. Because I used to, Mahalia, of course, being named after Mahalia Jackson, one of my favorite singers ever, I sort of played Mahalia Jackson, and I played Tina Turner, and I played Aretha Franklin, and, you know, all these great singers to Mahalia when she was young, and Ray Charles and people like that. And so, you know, Mahalia was sort of destined, you know, whether she liked it or not, she was going to be a soul singer, you know. She just, and it all rubbed, she took it all in like a sponge, and, you know, she's one of the great singers in this country now. But it used to be great, because when she was about three, you know, like, you know, she'd come up, you know, kids come up saying, hey, put the Wiggles on, you know.
Yeah. Mahalia
come up to me and say, Daddy, will you play Aretha Franklin? I go, yes, I will, no problem. I put on Respect, and, you know, she'd dance and stuff. So, yeah, my kids were influenced by soul music. And then as they grew up, they found all the new soul music. And, you know, Mahalia's sort of a big influence on me now. So it's like full role reversal.
Who she introduced you to?
Oh, you know, just, I mean, through the 90s and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
All sorts of singers, whether it's, you know, you know, you know, one, what's her name? You know, just all the great black American singers. And, you know, you know, she picked up, see, I was a huge Tina Turner fan.
Mm.
He picked up on Tina when Tina made her comeback. And I was like, oh yeah, I like this. And in my head, he was digging up old Ike and Tina Turner records, you know, like when she was, when, you know, before, you know, or live versions of songs.
Oh, some of those performances are out of control.
Electric. So, you know, it was things like that, you know, Mary J. Blige, all that sort of
thing. Yes, all the 90s R&B, you're taking me back now.
Mahia sort of and EJ, they all played me stuff like that, and so, and this is music that I completely missed, skimmed over, and I'm going, man, this person can sing, you know, it was really, you know, it was really great.
We have to sort of stick with 1985 actually for this playlist, Jimmy. So speaking of those Glaswegian artists, like your grandmother, I'd like to hear more about her a little bit later on, but Glasgow artist is Simple Minds.
When I heard Simple Minds, first thing I heard was The American, by the way, which I just thought it was incredibly. It was came from that new age, you know, sort of not new romantic, because the Scots were never romantic, like hardcore anyway. But it sort of had those influence of all those you know, English, you know, romantic pop bands were at the time, but of course coming from you know, Britain. Coming from Scotland, I mean, they had this edge to them. And when I heard Simple Minds, you know, the first time, I did that American song, I just went, man, this is tough. This is great. I really like it. The song I picked today is Don't You Forget About Me, which was just such an epic anthem.
Here it is, Simple Minds with Don't You Forget About Me.
Love's strange, so real in the dark. Think of the tender things that we were working on.
About Me by Simple Minds, one of the song choices of my very special guest for this evening, Jimmy Barnes. It's the playlist for 1985, the best year ever. What has your live performance changed from when you were first performing these songs?
Well, you know, there's a lot changed since, you know, when I started performing, or even started my solo career. Let's go from there.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows what I did with Chisel. It was wild and all that sort of stuff. Getting into going solo, this period, 1985, was a make or break time for me as a solo artist. This was the record that I had to step up, and it was either going to, you know, make my career soar, or it was going to make me sort of crash like into the rocks. So, you know, I was sort of very aware of it, but it was still really, I was still trying to, you know, as much as, you know, I'd go up there and I'd say, this is what I've got to do. I've got to, you know, I've got to be more together. I've got to be more focused. And then I'd get on stage and I'd see the whites of the audience and eyes and just go for them and you know, and just do what I do best, which was letting go. The more I let go, things sort of seem to get better. So I've changed. I don't have to get hammered to let go these days. You know, those days I thought the only way I could sort of let go of my hang-ups and you know, and get loose was to get, you know, on the verge of being too loose, you know, whether it was drinking too much or taking drugs and all that sort of stuff. These days, I get on stage and I still have to find that spot where I can let go, because once you let go and it becomes effortless, then singing, then it's really great. That's when you connect with your audience. So I guess my goals are the same, just my methods are not the same anymore. And I'm healthier and fitter. You know, like I get up every day and swim a kilometer I don't drink a thing, you know, before I go on stage. I don't take any drugs. I'm really focused. You know, I'm a healthy guy these days, so it's good.
It's funny. You think back to those days and you think, what was I running from? You know, it's so amazing. And you're drinking, right? Like it's, yeah. I mean, this is zero. I'm not trying. Yeah.
No, exactly. I didn't really know then because I didn't want to look at any of it. I was running child abuse and, you know, sexual abuse.
Yeah.
all that pain and stuff that grew up in poverty and violence and alcoholism and all that sort of stuff. And it's funny because in running away from it, I sort of dragged all that stuff with me, and I ended up being, you know, bloody an alcoholic, and you know, I got a bit violent, and I was, you know, I was wild, and I was you know, trying to run away from that, but I was sort of running headlong into it. If I wasn't, and it was only I got to the point where I started realizing that, where I was really torn, and it nearly killed me. So, you know, I guess, you know, once I turned and looked at it, it's all the stuff. If you know what you're running from, and if you start dealing with it, you know, you're already on the front foot, you're winning. And so I think now all that stuff, which for that abuse and childhood abuse and stuff that I ran from, that really nearly killed me, is now one of my strongest allies. It's what I go to when I want, you know. Before, if I wanted, I could easily feel anger, I could easily feel pain, I could easily, you know, feel yearning and all that sort of stuff. Now I can do that in a heartbeat, but it doesn't overwhelm me. I can draw on those same emotions from the feelings that I had before, but they don't overpower me and they don't rule me. So I guess it's just a different way of looking at the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's extraordinary that you mentioned that you see the whites of the audience eyes. And I mean, that to me is just overwhelming, just that statement, to be in that position. But, you know, that's what gets you going now. I mean, what a change.
I'm not, but listen, I do. I pick people in the audience, key people in the audience to judge. You can see how people are judging a song. Some people are really just into it and they're great, and you go, they're going along for the ride with you. There's other people who are being critical, and you can see, all right, what am I going to do to get this guy? And there's other people who are maybe, you know, they don't really want to be there, and you go, well, I want to get that person on board. And there's other people who are, you know, non-committal, you know, they're there with someone else, and you get them on board. And so I literally look in people's eyes when I'm singing. And if I, you know, and there's literally, if there's someone in the audience that I can send sight, that I can see, that doesn't want to be there, that's the person that I go for. And if there's someone in the audience starting trouble, that's the person I go for, and I try and win them over and get them to just concentrate on the show. So, you know, it's sort of it's about the connection you make, you know, and in connecting with that one person, the people around them feel it, you know, and then that sort of builds through the crowd.
Well, Boys of Summer is Jimmy. This is your next song. Now, the Eagles initially turned this down and Don Henley went on to record it. Did you ever have any songs knocked back that you decided to persist with?
To stick through it? Yeah, I mean, from that first song, from this record, you know, No Second Prize, Promise Me, Boys Cry Out for War, I submitted for Cold Chisel. And at the time, you know, we were doing, I think some of them were around the time, Circus Animals. So we had a huge surplus of really good songs. And these songs, I'm just thinking, oh, they're going to go to waste. And part of that was the reason why I was looking forward to getting out and trying to make my own career, because I wanted to, you know, put my own ideas on the line. So I wasn't offended that Colchester didn't do them, because like I said, we had a lot of great tunes. But it sort of, I needed to get my confidence and to when I finally recorded those songs, I had to make them work for me. And it was a great time. I didn't know the Eagles knocked back Boys of Summer. It was a big mistake.
Yeah, here it is, Boys of Summer by Don Henley. Boys of Summer by Don Henley. It certainly was a bad idea to reject that.
Besides being a good song, I reckon it's influenced a lot of songs in production wise and techniques and all that. I mean, I mean, even if you want to, you know, go, you know, 10 years down the track or whatever, not even, but you know, I mean, you know, it influenced, I reckon, a couple of years later, you know, You're the Voice was probably influenced by the production of that, you know, by John Farnham. Certainly Daryl Braithwaite's, you know, comeback was sort of influenced by that type of production. That song and that production influenced a hell of a lot of songs. And Don Henley, you know, in the Eagles, Don Henley is the great singer, I think, you know. Besides being the drummer, I've been and seen the, Jane's a big fan, my wife, and I go see the Eagles. And, you know, I love Joe Walsh and I love Don Henley because Joe's a soulful guitar player and Don Henley sings like an angel, you know.
I'm here with Jimmy Barnes for our Nightlife Music Special, 1985, best year ever. Jimmy's picked some banger tracks to play through. Another great artist, you know how they have sister cities, Jimmy? I think of this next artist like your brother equivalent, you know, national icon, working class hero. It is, of course, Bruce Springsteen.
It's funny, you know, when I was going to America around this time, they were, American record company were trying to sell me to radio and to press and that, and they're saying, oh, this is, you know, Australia's Bruce Springsteen, and I'm saying, yeah, don't say that, you know?
I am saying it all this time later.
imagine if you know, like, a young artist was coming from America and going, you know, this is America's Jimmy Barnes, you know, the Australians would have gone, oh yeah, come on. I was a bit worried, but you know, you'll notice this is a good thing for you. I put two songs back to back here. Bruce, you know, I'm on Fire, which is an incredible song. You know, it was a really killer album, this one that came out. And then I've got right next to it, I've got Tom Waits, Downtown Train, which is Tom Waits is another great singer and really influential, not as big, obviously, as Bruce. But Jane, my wife, whenever I'll play Bruce and she loves Bruce, and then I'll play Tom and she'll hear the start of the intro for like Downtown Train and she go, oh, is this Bruce? And I go, no, this is Tom. But when I think about it, Tom's sort of like Bruce with influenza. Both of them are really great lyricists, great writers, and you know, and both songwriters influence so many people. That's why I sort of tied these two together. I thought, you know, you can hear the sort of best of American music between these two songs.
Here it is, I'm on Fire.
It's like someone took a knife, baby, edgy and dull, and cut a 6-inch valley through the middle of my skull. At night I wake up with the sheets soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of my head. Only you can cool my desire. Ooh, I'm on fire.
Ooh, Bruce Springsteen, I'm on Fire, one of the picks of Jimmy Barnes for our Saturday night music playlist, best year ever, 1985. Now, Jimmy, you did a duet with Bruce Springsteen in 2013. What was that like?
Awesome. I mean, there was a couple of things about it. You know, I've been a big fan of Bruce's for a long time. I love the fact that his commitment to his show, you know, like I talk about mine, that connection to an audience. He has that in space, you know. Mm. When I opened up for him down at Hanging Rock, and you know, got to talk to him. He was a lovely chap, and he said, "Oh, you should come up and have a sing." And I said, "Sure, I'd love to." He said, "What songs do you know?" And I said, "I know them all." And he sort of looked at me at the corner of his eye, and I think he's a stalker, you know. What songs do you want to do? And I picked a song called "Tougher Than the Rest," which was one of my favorite Springsteen songs from the Tunnel of Love, and when I got up and sang with him. Because I got there and he said, "Oh, we got the words on the screen for you if you want to look at them." I said, "Oh, I know them, it's okay." And he's, once again, he's going, "Oh, hang on a minute.
Is this guy a fanboy?"
Fanboy. But I got up there and I'd sang harmonies to that song every time I play it. I sing along with Bruce, you know. So I just sang the part I normally do when I'm doing my home, you know, at home listening to music. And so it followed him perfectly. And we loved it. But the great thing about him was I got up there and his band were one of those bands that they all watch the singer. I love bands where they watch the singer. If he moved his leg, you know, the band did an accent. If he turned his arm one way, you know, the guitar player would come in with an arpeggio. And his band did that. And the other great thing about getting up with Bruce was, you know, I'm a big fan of his guitar playing. It doesn't get spoken about a lot because he's got, you know, Stevie Van Zandt and Nils Lofgren and all those people playing guitar with him. Bruce is a fantastic guitar player. And I got up there and his guitar on stage was deafening. It was so loud coming behind me. And I was so impressed with that because I like loud guitars. And it made me just go, yeah, Bruce, you're the man. You're the boss.
You're the boss, yeah. Next up, Jimmy, we've got Bruce Springsteen with Influenza. You described him, Tom Waits. Go on.
I'm a fan of Tom Waits. I actually met Tom in Melbourne many, many years ago, in about 1979 or something. And he came out to Australia for a promo tour, and he was just hilarious. It's when he was still really drinking, and he was drinking quite heavily. And so was I, but I met him for promo. We're staying at the same hotel and both in the same record company. And the record company guy was there. And I was ordering like some bacon and eggs and a coffee. And he had a double bourbon and Coke. So,
Good morning.
I get to see you here. But I've just been a fan of his songwriting. I love how he thinks outside the box, you know. The production values, there's lots of mistakes on his records because it's all about getting the feel. It's all about, you know, keeping the atmosphere and keeping the commitment to the groove and commitment to the flow of the music. You know, I like music where, you know, once you start it, you don't stop. You don't stop going, oh, no, I think we could do that better. You know, continue on and leave, you know, what's mistakes are sort of, it's like flaws in people. They're normally the things that I like best. You know, they're the things you remember about people. It's not when they're perfect. You go, oh, it's perfect. Who cares? You see somebody and there's something about them that might rub you a little bit, or you go, oh, he's quirky. He's a bit shifty. But that's what I like about people. And it's the same with singers and songwriters. And Tom leaves all the warts and all on his records, and it's just beautiful.
Well, let's hear him, warts and all. Tom Waits, Downtown Train.
They try so hard to break out of their little worlds. Well, you wave your hand and they scatter like crows. They have nothing that will ever capture your heart. They're just thorns without the rose. Be careful of them in the dark. Oh, if I was one, chose to be your only one. Oh yeah, can't you hear me now? Can't you hear me now? I see you tonight on a downtown train. Every night it's just the same. You leave me lonely now. I know your window and I know it's late.
That was Downtown Train by Tom Waits. I'm here with Jimmy Barnes. 1985 was the best year ever for tonight's music playlist. So, Jimmy, we mentioned before your daughter Mahalia really getting into those old school performances of Tina Turner when she was still performing with Ike. Look, your duet with her as well, it was iconic in 91. It looked like a lot of fun. I mean, that looks like the golden age, I think, sometimes of Australian music. You know, I'm a millennial, I'm younger. So to me, I look back and I just have such, you know, wow, what would that have been like? You know, can you tell me?
You know, like I literally seen Tina. I went and seen her when I was 14, I think, like Tina Turner. And me and my hoodlum mates, we're all, you know, a bunch of thugs. We kicked the back door of the stadium in and 10 of us charged through, and there was only a couple of security guys, so they could only catch one or two. And the rest of us got in. And I remember running to the front of the stage. They were on stage. And I stood in the front. And there was Tina in all her glory. You know, it's just like, first you're struck, you know, to the way she looked. She was striking, you know, with those legs and the dancing and the shimmying and all that. But I stood there and she was just delivering. This voice was so incredible and so powerful and so emotional and painful. It was great. And I thought, that's what I literally went, that's what I'm going to do. That's it. And so Tina meant a lot to me. I remember looking past and seeing Ike Turner. And Ike was this guy who was, you know, we all know how he turned out to be a nasty cat. You have to drive a band. And he pushed that band so hard. And the band was so concentrated and locked in on him and on the singer. And I went, I'm going to sing like her and I want to run a band like him. But so I learned a lot from that one show. And fast forward 35 years or whatever it was to when the rugby league asked me to come and sing with them. You know, she'd come back and made this big record the first big record, she, you know, What's Love Got to Do with It and all that sort of stuff. And I remember I bought, before that record came out, she was booked to do a Hilton tour, you know, like a dinner show. And I bought tickets to the Hilton tour. And then this record came out, and she was the biggest artist in the world. And the record show, the Hilton show, had been sold for 6 months before. And you know, any artist, you know, could have quite easily have said, "Look, I can't do that show. I've got to do a stadium instead." But she'd stuck to her commitments and did the show. And I went and watched her at the Hilton. And once again, it was in this intimate. I was up close, and she was just so powerful. So I was mesmerized. I got asked to do the Rugby League song, and I went to Amsterdam to sing and do the film clip for the Rugby League. And she was just, you know, like people think, you know, you meet your people you look up to, and quite often they let you down a bit, which is okay. But she was way beyond what I expected. She was so powerful, so nurturing, so giving, so emotional. One of the best voices I've ever heard in my life, bar none. It was incredible.
Let's hear her. Here is Tina Turner with What's Love Got to Do with It.
It's physical. Must try to ignore that it means more than that. Oh, what's love got to do with it? What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? It may seem to you that I'm acting confused. You're close to me. If I tend to look dazed, I read it someplace. I've got cause to be. There's a name for it.
That was What's Love Got to Do with It. I'm here with Jimmy Barnes. We're playing the best songs in Jimmy's opinion. I think it's pretty unanimous, though, from the year 1985. Jimmy, onto a different style now, the Pogues and their version of Dirty Old Town. Tell me about this song.
Well, the Pogues were a band that really was had a foot in two worlds, you know, that whole Irish folk and British folk music and punk. And they sort of bridged the gap between you know what you know because yeah you look at the power of punk music when it came and you look at John Lydon, you know, and he was listening to, you know, his Irish blood, and he's listening to Irish music as a kid brought up in an Irish home sort of thing. So Ireland really influenced punk music anyway. Ireland's rebellious. The Pogues, you know, I think you know, they were just an incredible. They were folk music, but it was power punk, and they were unique in the world to do that. And at that time in 1985, when everybody was, you know, really, it was about, you know, MTV and all that sort of stuff, and everything was looking good. And then you got Shane McGowan with no teeth, and you know, and off his head on Guinness and you know, heroin and whatever. And he, you know, and he was sort of the anti-Christ of pop music. But he was still writing these songs, you know. It was wild and it was raucous, and they were out of it, but moving, you know. They talk about music for like working class, you know. I Met My Love by the Gaswork Wall, you know. Dreamed a Dream by the Old Canal, you know. It was really working class music of the time, and you know, we don't get to meet, you know, working class people. We don't get to meet people on gondolas in Venice, you know. If you meet them on the assembly line and things like that, and I thought that singing a love song, you know, for you know, a girl you've met, you know, on the way to work in the morning, this was a beautiful thing. And I think the Pogues did that so well, and I love the fact that they were in the middle of all this glitzy, shiny MTV culture music, and they shone through, and they still did until Shane died. I think they're coming out here very soon, actually.
Oh, good to know. Well, here they are, the Pogues, Dirty Old Town.
Dirty old town, dirty old town, clouds are drifting across the moon, cats are proud. Their beams,
girl from the streets at night. Dirty old town, dirty old town.
With Dirty Old Town, playing Jimmy Barnes' Best Year Ever, songs from 1985. Jimmy, we don't have much time. This always happens with playlists where we get...
I tell you, Brothers in Arms, you know, I like Dire Straits from the minute I heard them. Only, you know, many years later I found out that Mark Knopfler was Scottish.
Oh, right.
So there you go. It's a Scottish connection to this song. And that album, Brothers in Arms, was the biggest, that was a live record. It was huge when it came out that year. I remember it was just on the radio everywhere. And it almost put me off Dire Straits completely. But the guitar playing on this song is so beautiful and so melodic, and it sounds Celtic to me. So
here it is, Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached high. And though it had been so bad, in the fear and alarm,
Dire Straits, what? Brothers in Arms. Now, Jimmy, you knocked them off the number one spot on Australia's charts.
Because they'd been around for like 16 weeks or something. They'd sold 14 entertainment centres out in Sydney or something. They were massive. Yeah. But I tell you, that song was so beautiful, I didn't mind. I didn't mind having to work hard to do it.
We got to get some Aussie songs in there as well, don't we? So one of your picks is The Divinyls. Tell me why.
Yeah, well, with The Divinyls, we were sort of, like, we were soulmates, you know. Man, Chrissy is a dear friend of mine. When Chrissy first came onto the scene, Vince Lovegrove, who was managing her, came to me and said, "Oh, you're going to see this band. This girl is like a female Jimmy Barnes." And when I went and seen her, she was much more than that. Very incredible. I love Chrissy so much, and I thought that chemistry that her and Mark McEntee, the songwriting and the music they made together, was incredible. So Chrissy actually, just as a side note, Chrissy and I became really great friends over the years. And many years later, when Steve Presswich died in Cold Chisel and we lost our drummer, Chrissy turned to her partner, who was Charlie Drayton, one of the best soul drummers in the world, and said, "I think Cold Chisel are going to need you soon." And that was before we'd even thought about putting Charlie as a drummer for Cold Chisel. And sure enough, we thought about it in, you know, separately, and called, and Chrissy was influential in getting him in the band. The last time Chrissy performed on stage was singing Saturday Night with Cold Chisel in Adelaide, which was my hometown. And it was so moving. And I was so glad to share the stage with my dear friend and one of the most powerful performance I've ever seen in the world.
I'd love to track down that version. I'd love to hear that. That's one of my Chisel favourite. So we're coming to the end of the Best Year Ever playlist, 1985, Jimmy. Let's end on some more Aussies. Look, before we play the song, it's in excess, right? But is that how you'd sum up Australia's music scene in 1985? Or how else would you do it more artfully than that?
These guys in one, they're the, you know, NXS as a young up and coming band from the North Shore used to come and support Cold Chisel, and we always seen something in them. And I remember Richard Clapton was producing some songs for them, and I'd see them, and they're really quirky, and they had this little, they had this sound. It was a little Ricky Ticky, and you know, but and this band was sort of like making these funny little grooves, but Michael was just like the striking singer. go forward to this, what you need. And, I think it's working with Mark Opitz. And suddenly the band went from being this little sort of, Northern Beaches band to this having this epic sound. The rhythm section just came out of nowhere and sideswiped me. They're incredible. And this song, I think, was them, this was them breaking into the world. They'd already, this time and stuff had already been through and stuff like that. And they made some great music. But I feel this song was the one where it was there announcing to the world, here we are. And they went on from there to do some, to be one of the biggest bands Australia's ever exported. Michael, my good friend Michael, one of the most charismatic singers you've ever seen, and one of the most, great people to talk to, intellectual, clever, warm, friendly, funny. It was a huge loss when we lost them. And my heart goes out to this band because they just found their feet and became the greatest band in the world when they lost their singer. And Michael's the hardest man in the world to replace. So, when I listen to this, I just think of what might have happened had it been around another 40 years later.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, announcing to the world, here we are, and we're what you need. It's What You Need by NXS. Yeah, that was NXS, What You Need, our final song for the best year ever, 1985, the playlist chosen personally by the one and only Jimmy Barnes. Now, Jimmy, the tour is about to kick off. Where are you heading first?
We start off the 22nd in Mount Dunedin in Geelong, which is great, another working class town.
Yep.
Another town that was really, supportive of us, Cole Chisel, when we first started, and me when I started solo. So it was really, really fitting to go back to our working class roots and play. We're playing in a winery, which is a bit more upper class than that. But it's a town that I've got a lot of heart. It's got a lot of heart, and I've got a lot of time for. And so I'm really looking forward. I'm playing with Mossy. I'm playing with Ice House. I'm playing with Kate Sobrano, and a guy called John Rooney is opening the show. And John Rooney is the surgeon that did three surgeries on my hip. And when I went in to get the hospital, John said, "Oh, you know me." And John's band used to support Cold Chisel back in the 70s. So this is like, it's really great to bring all my good friends back together and hit the stage. And I can't wait.
Oh, yeah. And we can't wait either. It's been an absolute joy speaking to you, Jimmy. I've really, really enjoyed myself. And I'm sure those listening at home have just had a blast. Great songs, great chat, and a real honour to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you too. It was really great. Thanks, Greta.
No worries, Jimmy. And I think I might just add one more question. If you could bring something forward from 1985, the best year ever, what would you bring forward to now that we don't have, that we've lost?
Oh, I'd bring Michael Hutchins over and Chrissy Amphlett. I'd love to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh.
A lot of great artists from this country, but those two were so unique in the world. They were bright shining stars that we lost, and in the skies of over Australia got a little darker after they left.
You're absolutely right. We're lucky to have you and all these opportunities to see you bringing all the greats, all your good mates back together for this epic tour to celebrate the 40th anniversary of For the Working Class Man. Jimmy Barnes, thank you very much for joining Nightlife.
All the best.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.